the monologue.
Well, it was completely inevitable in Vancouver, British Columbia. And I suspect it's an issue that's going to come into play here in Seattle. A city council member in Vancouver, British Columbia, handed out free heroin, cocaine, and meth, and I'm not making this part up at all, that she says was purchased from the dark web. And I think it's going to happen here in Seattle eventually. The city council member's name, they call them counselors there, Jean Swanson. And I spoke to her over the weekend over the phone, and she admits that she was distributing the drugs to groups in the area, nonprofits in the area, to give to addicts. She acknowledges the stunt was illegal. She knows it was illegal, but she's not really worried about getting into any trouble. She did this in protest. She called it a civil disobedience, that it was meant to bring attention to the growing fatal overdose crisis in Vancouver and really the region. Now, I consider this an inevitable next step, because you had in Vancouver that established a government establishment of the heroin injection sites, right? And the argument for heroin injection sites is that we need to bring them in because we want to make sure that they are safe. This is about not treating the addiction. It used to be pitched as, oh, no, this will get people off of heroin or whatever it is they're on. They ditched that. Now they call it a safe consumption model, even though it's not safe to shoot up. It's safer to do it in front of a medical professional with clean needles, right? It's safer, but it's not safe. But their whole pitch was people are dying out on the streets. We have some moral obligation to make sure that they don't die. Now, that's where we usually on the right disagree with them on the left, is the moral obligation to me is to make sure they don't die by treating their addiction, not by giving them free space, a back rub, maybe some moonlighting, a nice soundtrack on in the background to shoot up. That's our difference. But their argument was we're doing this for safety. Okay. Well, as you know, because we've been covering it on the show so often, lots of the drugs, the supply, not only in British Columbia, but in the United States, in Washington, in Oregon, is being laced with fentanyl. Fentanyl is really, really easy to transport into the United States, particularly since we have an open border that the Mexican drug cartels are taking advantage of. They took advantage of our drug permissive policies last year and the year before that. They're definitely taking advantage of it now, more so. And even a small amount of fentanyl could be deadly. And the people who are shooting up or taking meth, whatever it is, their drug of choice, a lot of it is laced with fentanyl, and they don't even know it. And so if the argument is we want to keep it safe for the people to shoot up, well, why wouldn't the argument then be to make sure that the drugs that they're taking is, quote unquote, safe, isn't laced with the fentanyl or anything else? This counselor, Swanson, called it poison that's put into these drugs. She doesn't consider the drug itself poison, but what's in the drug poison, what's being laced in the drug poison. So what exactly would be the argument, logically, to stop the government from then buying the drugs and distributing it after ensuring that it's not laced with different things to the addicts? Just remember, they've given up on treating the addiction. In fact, I can tell you this. In British Columbia, they are moving forward with a plan to buy, quote unquote, safe drug supplies for the addict. They already announced it. They're putting in $22 million for a program province-wide to give out opioid replacement options, including fentanyl patches and tablets. And eventually, they're going to offer stimulants or prescribed heroin. This is the government doing it. In fact, it's controversial there only in that proponents argue that the approach is acting too slowly. They're not implementing it fast enough. So understand that that is where we are. And for this counselor to go ahead and admit that she's handing out substances at a time where the province is already moving forward with that plan shows you how lost Vancouver is. We pick up on some of those policies. The reason why we had the conversation here in the movement in Seattle for heroin injection sites, which is still on the table, is because of what happened in Vancouver. The heroin injection sites in Philadelphia happened because of what's going on in Vancouver. There are people here right now who are activists asking essentially for the same thing. We've already legalized drugs when it comes to personal use in the state of Washington. Right? So where do you think this is going to end? Now, if you want to read more about this, Text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. You text R-A-N-T-Z to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll go ahead and send you a link to this story so you can read and share. Now this.
The interview.
Seattle Inspector General is out with her report concerning the work that the Seattle Police Department did in tackling the Summer of Love, which included lots of riots and other rallies that got completely out of control. This is the same Inspector General, just for context, who a few weeks ago indicated that cops should not pull people over because they are in danger every single time a cop pulls someone over, especially if they're a person of color. So we don't want to shade the context too much, but that's the context. Joining me on the line is Hannah Scott from our sister station, Car Radio. So can I guess, because I haven't read the actual Inspector General report, it's very critical.
Yeah, but, you know, it's critical and it's about, but, you know, it's not set up to be that way. This is a report. It's called a Sentinel Review. And it basically was a discussion between community members, as well as several Seattle police officers of different ranks and the Inspector General. So they had open discussions and followed this process for what is a Sentinel Review. It's meant to be kind of peaceful and restorative, healing, if you will. So it wasn't really a pointing fingers at. It was a, what can we do different is the way they're framing it.
Okay, what could we have done differently?
Well, so to be clear, this is 112 pages, and I'm still going through the bulk of it, but there are 54 recommendations. And I should be clear, this is also just the first of several reports based on that will come out on the protests from last year. This particular report only deals with the initial days of protests, so May 29th through June 1st. So that would be the first protest that happened in the International District, then the big one we had in downtown Seattle that Saturday, and then culminating in the so-called Pink Umbrella incident up outside the East Precinct on June 1st. So just those 4 days, and 54 total recommendations they came up with here. The ones that they've come up with are all falling into five categories, and there are here's the category. So community legitimacy, what that has to do with is it says addressing the gap between what SPD is allowed to do based on the law or whatever their policy is, and then what its officers need to do to meet the standards of justice that are expected by the community, two things that are probably fairly different. So there's several recommendations in there to try to figure out how to address that gap. Situational awareness, and I've heard a lot about this in the various kind of report cards that have come out on the SPD response to protests. It's basically saying that the Seattle police need to change their mindset when they respond to protests, when it's protest about them, right? When it's a protest of the cops. So instead of kind of having this mindset of crowd management and control, they want him to focus on facilitating the crowd and the crowd's safety. That'll be a bit of a shift, I think, for law enforcement.
Well, it's also absolutely revisionist history. I mean, when we're talking about these kinds of protests, the ones that they're focused on actually posed a danger to the police. This was not just showing up and peacefully protesting. This was showing up with the intent of doing harm.
Well, it depends on which one of these days you look at. So I think that you could say that for sure about the May 30th protest in downtown Seattle. There was certainly intended harm, you know, to businesses and things like that.
Income.
That was where, And then on June 1st, there was one, I was in that protest for the entirety of the day, all the way up to when the tear gas came out. And there was one thing thrown at the officers that I saw. And I was pretty much right there up front for the whole thing. So I don't know that I would describe that one as his intent on harming the officers as some of the others that I had been in.
What was the intent of that particular rally in the context of it happening a day after a riot in which cops were told that they are racist murderers and need to be dismantled? Right.
It was two days after, and I'll tell you what the context was.
I mean, but the context of the people who, not all of the people, but a lot of the people, was to take over that East Precinct. It was to push them out of the community, and it was to do harm. This whole idea.
And I totally disagree with you there.
Okay.
And I was in this protest all day long. What this was, and I can never remember her name. She was one of the original organizers with the long braids, right? And she had led what was initially a small group of people marched all around the city for hours and hours. And they wanted to march and end at walk past the East Precinct. And then the police put out a line for whatever reason. They had intelligence, perhaps, that something was going to go down.
That was the report at the time. Yeah.
That's disputable, you know, depending on who you ask. Whatever the case, there was that woman and everyone who was at the front of the line for the very longest time was trying to engage with the officers, was trying to talk with them, which, you know, it doesn't, they don't generally engage in that. Your general rank and file are not going to sit and chit chat with the front line of the protesters. And they didn't for the most part. At one point, though, there was an officer who came and knelt with that leader of the protest, and he got a big cheer. So it was really, it was an effort, from my takeaway, to try to engage with the police, have discussions with the police, kind of explain their side of things to these police. In the end, there was a lot of force there, and there was some rowdier people who showed up late. There was some drunk people in the crowd, and things just got way out of hand.
And when did the cops respond with force? Was it during the peaceful time, or was it towards the end when the violent people showed up? It was towards the end.
But again,
and that's all I mean.
Yeah.
And I'll give you the last word. We only got about 20 seconds left.
Okay. So quickly, I want to get to a couple of things. The other few pots that we have here are community and community engagement, improving the ability of the cops to communicate with protesters, not just during, but before and after. So that's kind of what we talked about. Tactics and equipment during a crowd, which is basically, you know, maybe don't focus on busting people for low-level offenses because it tends to escalate the crowd. The one I really like here is officer wellness and training. And I'm glad to see that this is in here. This is prioritizing officer wellness and recognizing that these exceptionally long shifts in these hostile environments that the police encounter during these protests take a toll on the cops that can have a very lasting effect and impact all kinds of things.
It would be great if the council didn't defund the police so that we can actually have enough staff members to not have to force people into 12, 14, 16-hour shifts where they are taking an emotional toll every single time that they're being called bastards who murder black people. We've been talking with Hannah Scott. The full report is available online. Just go check out MyNorthWest.com. Running late, thank you so much for stopping by. Appreciate it. Now this.
The monologue.
I told you yesterday. In fact, I even have the Jason Rancho video update that is available right now on all my platforms, thanks to the Novak team powered by Keller Williams. Visit them online at meetthenovaks.com. Every Thursday, I do a Jason Rancho video update. And the topic today was all about how folks are going to use the story of the Delta variant to continue a push for more and more and more testing. And we frame it around Bill Gates, because Bill Gates, alongside George Soros, just purchased a company for COVID testing. And of course, the way that they frame it, this is all about making sure that we can get affordable testing to people who need it most. This is, I believe, going to be all about the money. It's all about making the money. And so lo and behold, I see all of the talking points, all of the scripts being played out right in front of us as it relates to using the Delta variant, which is not in any way more deadly or even more dangerous in any way than the other variants. The only difference is it's more contagious. So it's just as deadly, depending on your demographic. And for the most part, we're talking about, when we say deadly as it relates to COVID, we're talking about people in a very specific age range. Well, now that we have here in Washington State an increase in Delta cases, you've got folks looking to get tests. Talking to Cairo 7, Michael Fernstrom, for example. He went to go get a test at the Soto test site run by Seattle Fire. He said he was doing it. He just wants to play it safe.
Just in case. In case not a cold. Right. Just stay safe and keep people healthy.
You know, he's just being safe. Laura Gilgore, another person getting COVID tested. She's hoping for the best, obviously.
It's a little concerning. Going to go home and get quarantined, so we should be okay. Hopefully we come out and it says we're good.
Now, for the most part, people who go ahead and get tested, they usually come out fine on the other side, knowing that they didn't, in fact, catch COVID. That they're just acting out of an abundance of caution. And I don't blame them for wanting to go get tested. Some people wanting to get tested all the time because we are being told over and over and over again about COVID. It is being framed in a way to scare you into getting a vaccine. But when you also hear stories about vaccine breakthrough cases where someone who is vaccinated ends up getting COVID, well, guess what? You're scaring a lot of people unnecessarily into getting tested. And as Dr. Avanika Waring said, she's with Kaiser Permanente of Washington, they're seeing a whole bunch of more people getting tests.
We are seeing an increase in symptomatic testing requests by about 50% at our institution at Kaiser Permanente, because I think we are definitely, you know, seeing more with the Delta variant.
Okay, the Delta variant is scaring people into getting tested. There's free testing around the city of Seattle and elsewhere. Curative, for example, is a walk-up kiosk. But right now, they're getting really, really full because so many people are coming in and trying to get tests. On top of that, we're getting into cold and flu season. People are taking off their masks. They're getting sick with non-COVID issues. Got a sore throat. All of a sudden, they think, oh my gosh, I must have COVID. Here's Captain Duncan Jewell from Seattle Fire.
People are getting out more now, and so they're catching common colds and other viruses that they want to rule out the COVID.
Exactly. And who is there to make, at the end of it, some money off of it? I suspect it's going to be the people who invest in all the testing technology, sort of like a Bill Gates and a George Soros.
The interview.
Was it a slip up, or did Joe Biden last night indicate he's actually truly trying to ban now handguns, pistols? Joining me on the line with the Second Amendment Foundation is our friend Dave Workman. Dave, I'm assuming you saw some of the clips from the town hall with Joe Biden last night on CNN, in which the president kind of indicated that he was going to go after handguns. It seemed to be a lot of false statements made in his section on guns.
Well, Joe Biden, I'm not sure if he knows what he's saying half the time about any subject anymore. I kind of think it might have been a Freudian slip. And he didn't really mean to say that, but that's what he really meant. So, yeah. And you know, Biden is a career anti-gunner. I mean, for the past 48 years, he's been running around Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill trying to erode the Second Amendment. So what he said on TV at the town hall, I mean, that it's not new. It's not new at all. It's just more honesty, I guess, when he didn't really intend it.
And in that case, is it actually honesty?
So where do you think we stand, though?
At the end of this, where do you think we stand? Obviously, they are increasing, folks on the left are increasing the rhetoric around banning guns. Do you ultimately think it is a political play for the base, or do you think there's a legitimate threat?
Well, both. I think there is a legitimate threat, but I also believe that Joe Biden is bending over backwards to satisfy his political base because he wants to keep them fired up. He needs to have those people energized because we're coming into the midterm. You know, the midterm elections are only about 15 months away, and right now the campaigns are already getting started for that. There are people considering to run against some Democrat incumbents as Republicans, and they're looking ahead to November 2022 because they could easily lose the whole ball game if they lose Capitol Hill to the GOP. Biden knows this, and so does Kamala Harris. She may wind up being the president of a Senate that's dominated by a party that thinks she's no good at all. If the House changes hands to the Democrats, I think Pelosi is going to retire.
Do you have any sense as to whether or not there are Republicans on board with some of the gun restrictions?
Yeah, there have always been some Republicans who, in their heart of hearts, really don't like the idea of people having a lot of firearms. But I think on the whole, we've got a Republican Party now that is more conservative. I think they're leaning farther to the right than during the past, say, two decades or so. You'll see that, I think, coming out as we get closer to the Supreme Court taking up that case out of New York, where the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association is challenging the good cause part of the concealed carry laws back there. Now, 175 members of the House, I think, have signed on to an amicus brief that was filed the other day in support of the gun group's lawsuit. I think there are 25 members of the U.S. Senate that joined in a separate brief, and that one was started by Ted Cruz down in Texas. Mitch McConnell has signed onto that too. I reported about that the other day in Ammoland. So I think really the people in the GOP who are, you know, wishy-washy on guns, they're a relative handful of people.
A small group, and hopefully they won't have that much influence.
You know, and frankly, Jason, this is an opportunity for the Republicans to make gun rights, not gun control, but gun rights, a decidedly toxic campaign issue for the Democrats. And I think they've got it coming.
They do have it coming. They're certainly talking about it in a way that is much more aggressive than they have in the past. We've been talking with Dave Workman from the Second Amendment Foundation, the website saf.org, saf.org. Dave, thank you so much for stopping by. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rantz.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rantz, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
37 of our 39 sheriffs here in Washington have signed on to a new letter promising that they're going to uphold your constitutional rights. But it is rubbing some folks the wrong way because they wonder whether or not these sheriffs even have the authority to do so. So let's talk with one of the sheriffs who has signed on to this letter. Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett joins me now. Sheriff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you having me on.
So first, let's just dive into what was the impetus for this letter? Why did you decide to write it?
Well, you know, it goes back to early June. I actually saw an article in a paper with the Utah Sheriff's Association, all 29 elected sheriffs did a much similar letter with almost the same language. And it really struck a chord with me. And it's like I had been hearing for especially during the COVID time, you know, so the last year and a half, it really, really cranked it up. But people have always been concerned. Messaging that's been coming down from a national level. And then when you look at things going on legislatively and then COVID kicks in, people are concerned in a lot of different ways. And as a sheriff, we hear from them. And so, you know, I like this. I'm the current vice president for the Washington State Sheriff's Association. So I drafted one up to fit our members, sent it to the other board members and said I'd really like for us to agree to send this out to our members to see if others want to sign on to this. The board unanimously said, yes, let's do that. So we sent it out to our members. We actually had 38 of 39 when we did our original vote. But Gary Simpson, Kitsap County Sheriff at the time, retired on June 30th, and we didn't finalize everything until, you know, later into July. And so at that point in time, their county commissioners had not appointed an official sheriff. And so John Giese, who was the undersheriff at the time, just said he, under legal advice, he probably should not. But he did support that. So I think it's a pretty strong statement.
Well, King County Sheriff Mitzi Jo Hanknick is the only other one who has not signed on, although she is transitioning out of this particular role.
Correct.
So you focus in this letter, the one specific issue you get into is the Second Amendment. Over the course of the last legislative session, they didn't really do anything too much. They had one law that was passed that bans open carry at protests. Of course, it's only supposed to be towards folks who legally carry, not Antifa thugs and anyone else with their weapons. But why specifically the Second Amendment?
Well, that's the one that's always in the crosshairs. That's the one that people have been most concerned about for quite some time. And that's the one we hear the most about.
So there wasn't anything specific that caused that. This was more based on, I've got a bunch of constituents of mine, community members who are concerned about this, and we want to make sure they know very clearly where we stand.
Absolutely. But the current president of the United States makes it clear in his messaging. I'm going after your guns. He doesn't quote a policy that he has in place or a policy that he's drafting and would be such a great thing for the American citizens. He's just making an idle threat. And people sit back there and look at that and go, what in the world is he talking about? What did we do wrong? And you know, if you have a policy, put it out on the table. Let's talk about it. Show us how you think it's really going to work and how it's going to be effective. Don't just sit there and threaten the common citizen who's a hardworking, law-abiding citizen and paying their taxes. That doesn't work.
What has been the response you've received from this letter?
Outstanding, outpouring for myself. I'm getting contacted from people from that don't even live in Chelan County. People walking up on the street saying, "Hey, I appreciate you making a stand." And really, this isn't about the sheriffs. Although I guess I could back up and say, in some way, it is because there is an attack on the position and on the office of elected sheriff. You can look at it in legislation, especially in 2021. There's no doubt that somebody has an agenda. And if you come back and take a 30,000 foot view, somebody has a mind. Let's take away the local control because then we can shove down their throats in a community that we don't live in what we want them to do.
Exactly. And I think that's an important part. I mean, in King County, the voters, albeit it was mostly driven by Seattle activists, voted to take away the right to vote for a sheriff. The same threat from the same type of activists is happening right now in Pierce County. So there's very clearly a move from activists on the left to take away this right. At the same time, they had just passed a number of bills that will change the way you're allowed to legally do your job in law enforcement. So from your perspective as the sheriff of Chelan County going into this weekend with these new laws, what does policing look like?
It's 100% completely different. And it's not about the law enforcement leaders. It's not about the agencies themselves. It's about the men and women that actually walk the street and are actually responding to the calls, because now we have Criminal Justice Training Commission under the new decertification. You have, the use of force that's changing so much. So are they going to get decertified because, you know, they overstepped their boundaries from years and years of training and prior experience? And then are they going to lose their job? Are they going to get prosecuted? And so that really does change the way. And that's going to have a huge impact to public safety in our communities. The criminals are going to know right away what the new rules are and what they can get away with. And they're not going to stay away from that line.
Exactly.
What do they do? They cross the line, they stretch it, they push it. And so that's going to have an impact to my neighbors, your neighbors, and how they are going to be victimized.
Yeah,
and that is really, really a sad thing.
One of the specific issues is, for example, car chases, which are for the most part outlawed under the new law. Very narrow approval to go ahead and do this. And so what does that mean as far as the criminals are concerned? They're going to feel enabled, empowered to just drive away.
Well, let me say something pretty blunt. The word on the street right now is, things are so restrictive and with this and agencies are so concerned about the new laws that are going to affect on the 25th and just 3 days away that they're putting the brakes on. I mean, for agencies are saying, we're not even going to make traffic stops. We're going to wait and see and let some other small agency in their mind screw this up and make the LEDs, make the case law. And then once the stuff is established, and then we'll establish our protocol and our procedures. Journal policies, and then we'll train our people. Well, that's insane. At the same time, I look back and said, at some point in time, I have to manage risk, not just for the citizens, but for our employees as well. And so there is going to be a drastic change in the way we police until we get some defined language, because the legislators left a lot of things out. And I don't know if they were, well, obviously, I mean, the point is they continuously say, we don't need the subject matter experts anymore, because they're removing it in 5051. We saw it in the reorganization of the commission, so the Criminal Justice Training Commission. They removed the sheriff, one of two sheriffs. They removed one of the two chiefs. But yet we're putting on seven total citizens at large. Now, that in itself is not a bad thing, but why do you take away the subject matter experts, Jason? That makes no sense. We have to have people there that know the business, know the rights and the wrongs, and they know the effect that it's going to have, again, not just on the citizens and the people that we serve, but the men and women that are our employees that are actually putting their lives on the line.
Absolutely. So how does the letter sort of influence your willingness to abide by some of these new laws? Would you argue that the constitutional rights of citizens are in jeopardy as a result of some of these anti-police laws?
Yes, I in some ways I would, and this wasn't the intent of the writing. Unfortunately, the timing of it was just like the perfect storm, and everything's kind of coming down at the exact same time. I really wanted to release this, before the end of June. I would have loved to have it out, and I got tired of waiting, and so I released a personal one that was this really similar to this statement on July 1st, and I got criticized on that. Well, what's the significance of the timing of this? And I thought, well, Independence Day, that might be one, and I think I think it was appropriate. And I just wanted to send that message out because I was getting contacted. And again, you know, the biggest thing is I think criticized on the negative side is, well, why are you sticking up on the second? Why not the 14th? Why not the first? Why not this? And it's obviously because this is the one we're hearing the most. But, you know, without trying to say you're a conspiracy theory and you're super right wing and you're going to go after the Second Amendment. But we do know historically when the people lose certain rights, that's when they lose the rest. And if the first one goes as the Second Amendment, the rest potentially are soon to follow. And you can look around America, Jason, right now, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out, is to see that they're going after the cancel culture. They're doing a lot of different things. 12, 18 months ago, you would have never thought to see that, but yet it's coming down the pipe. And that's where we wake up and we say, whoa, yeah, there is some serious stuff going on. And maybe we do need to address this situation and let our citizens know that we have our back. And I'll go one step further. This isn't just for the people that believe or like the Constitution. The Constitution protects everyone. And the fact that the Constitution is not subject to the laws, but the law is supposed to be subject to the Constitution.
I hear you. And I think a lot of people, certainly when I talked about this letter yesterday, were backing you. I think there are some reasonable concerns about whether or not, you know, a sheriff is the right person to interpret some of these laws. And I think that is a valid concern that warrants conversation. But I'm not going to get in the way of a sheriff who is, you know, reading the writing on the wall and saying, yeah, we're going to make sure, just so all you guys know out there, we're not going to do anything that is very clearly unconstitutional. I think that is going to create a better relationship with a lot of folks in the community, although the activist community probably make it worse, but I don't know if it can actually get worse than it currently is. We've been talking with the sheriff of Chelan County, Brian Burnett. Sheriff Burnett, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate you just listening to our perspective and trying to get the real truth out there. Again, just a reaffirmation of the oath that we've already sworn and the same oath that we swear our own staff in on.
There you go. I think a lot of people are going to get behind that. You've been listening to The Jason Rantz Show. Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rantz, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
I have a story out over at foxnews.com in the editorial section. And it talks about the framing of the overdose crisis in the country. We just hit 93,000 overdose deaths. And the media coverage has been focusing this and framing this story around COVID, that COVID is to blame for the rise in numbers, the historic rise, the tragic rise in numbers. I disagree with that framing. I think the framing should be about Democratic policies, Democrats' policies, I should say, because they're not Democratic. We don't actually support them. But Democrat policies that effectively caused what it is we're seeing, or at least a large chunk of what it is we're seeing. I had that conversation about the issues with Bill Hemmer over at America's Newsroom.
Fatal overdoses in America topping 93,000 last year. That is an all-time high. Many are blaming the pandemic, but my next guest points to Democrat-run cities taking a soft approach on drugs. Radio host Jason Rantz with me now. Jason, nice to see you. Welcome back to our program today. You wrote a piece at foxnews.com. Here's your headline. Don't just blame COVID for surge in overdose deaths. Dems' bad policies are responsible, too. I'll go ahead and give you a chance to explain, Jason.
Yeah, COVID certainly exacerbated the issue, but fatal drug overdoses are surging because Democrats have effectively, and in some cases, literally legalized drugs while hamstringing police. So you look at Portland, Seattle, Chicago, Boston. These are cities that refuse to prosecute most drug crimes. And Democrats keep promising, hey, we're going to get treatment for addicts because we don't want to criminalize addiction. And instead, we're going to go after the drug dealers. But the problem is, addicts, many of them who are criminal, aren't compelled into treatment, and there are consequences for skipping out on treatment normally, but in this case, they're not. And they know that they're not going to be punished if they ignore the will of the courts, and so they don't actually change their behavior. While at the same time, dealers have evolved, they carry less product on them, and that way they can avoid arrest and prosecution. So essentially, they're gaming the system, and the drugs are flowing into our communities.
Well, I'm reading here, you write that Chicago has a 20% increase in overdose deaths. It's extraordinary. Portland's up 40%. But what about the Mexican drug cartels? What about the open border? What about the pictures we see from Customs and Border Patrol on a weekly basis about the amount of fentanyl and meth and cocaine they're seizing?
So clearly, the Mexican drug cartels have taken advantage of these drug permissive policies. There was a report that came out about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, from the DEA that showed that. Obviously, there's now a very open border that they are taking advantage of. They are flooding our cities with, in particular, fentanyl, which is really easy to get across the border. Even the smallest amount of fentanyl can cause a deadly overdose. And a lot of the drugs that we're seeing, especially in the Pacific Northwest, but really across the country, are laced with fentanyl. So people are taking meth or heroin. They're not realizing there's fentanyl in it. They overdo it and they end up dying. That is a big reason behind the surge in overdose death.
You ask a question. Why don't Democrats change their ways? Why not?
They don't change their ways because in this case, when we're talking about the drug legalization push, they're ideologues. They truly believe that the criminal justice system, especially when dealing with drug crimes, is infected with white supremacy, and it's a system of oppression that has to be dismantled. But at the same time, you can go ahead and talk about that all you want. You are killing these people every day. You allow the legalization of drugs without at least compelling treatment. They don't want any consequences when it comes to this, or even homelessness or any of these issues. They always seem to say, we want them to be ready, the suspects, the victims of this addiction to be ready, and then we'll treat them where they are. But if you are an addict, you're not going to just simply be ready. And usually at that time where just maybe you think you can reach them, it's going to be too late. We can say that for at least 93,000 people in this country.
Mm. Here's a paragraph. There's a progressive push to decriminalize and legalize drugs, you write. They argue that the justice system is racist and drug crimes disproportionately punish people of color, though that observation is lazy and disingenuous since the crimes are still occurring and are not the result of a conspiracy to plant drugs in innocent people. It leads to deadly consequences, end quote. Just to emphasize the point you're just making there. Jason, thank you. Come back. Check out the piece at foxnews.com.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
If you want to watch the video of that hit, that's what we call it. That's the lingo we use in the biz. Go ahead and subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jason Rants. youtube.com/Jason Rants. I was also on Fox News Primetime today. That video is going to be available shortly at youtube.com/Jason Rants.
The Last Rants.
As I've been looking at some of the stories around the country of communities stepping up and saying no to certain policies like critical race theory, when I hear from Dave Workman over the Second Amendment Foundation sounding the alarms of gun confiscation and saying very clearly we can't allow this to stand, when I hear from the Chelan County Sheriff Brian Burnett this hour saying, I'm making it clear to the community, like all these other sheriffs, that we are not going to abuse your constitutional rights, the theme very quickly emerges that we are all setting our standards for what we believe is and is not acceptable in our communities, in our country, right? That it is not acceptable to push this anti-racist, toxic garbage that actually is, in fact, racist on kids. That it's not okay for you to take away our gun rights, that it's not okay for you to take away any constitutional rights. We are setting standards that we need, we demand politicians, appointees, civil servants to adhere to. And they're reasonable and they're based in the law. And so I want you to think about for your own community, whatever issue it is, what are your standards that you want your community leaders to meet? And when they don't meet them, what are you going to do about it? We've talked a lot about getting more involved, and I've asked you to get involved. I've asked you to think about ways that you're comfortable getting involved, sending emails, making phone calls, knocking on doors to promote a candidate that you do support. So now you've got the tools you need, but what about the topic? What's the issue? What's that standard you're going to set for yourself? Think about that tonight. And then this week, what's left of it, and this weekend, let's commit to some action on it. And that's The Last Rants.